Fill in the blank. Money Machine. Show 80. End of September. Hello, everyone. This is Paul Douglas Boyer. Welcome back to the Mad Money Machine, the regular version of Mad Money Machine, not the interview version of Mad Money Machine. Show number 80. And coming up on this show, we will talk about why soccer is not big in America. We'll talk about cross-correlation in your portfolio. I'll take a caller who says thank you and a whole lot more on the Mad Money Machine. So I got up early the other day, 5 o'clock a.m. actually, to watch the Women's World Cup soccer. Brazil versus Australia, actually. And commentator and former soccer player Julie Foudy said something about the Australian team that I had to think about for a little while. She said, "The strength of this Australian team cannot be underestimated. They're very good." And I got to think about that. The strength of the Australian team cannot be underestimated. Cannot be underestimated. Underestimated. Does that make sense? I can see where if she had said the strength cannot be overestimated, meaning, wow, I estimate that they're pretty good. Oh, no, that's not an overestimate at all. They're very good. No, that's not even an overestimate. They're supremely good. But to say that they cannot be underestimated, meaning they're pretty bad, no, they're really bad. No, they're really, really bad, is the wrong way to say it. Now, another phrase that's misspoke often in the press is the use of the word investing, like the Investor's Business Daily. There's a podcast called The Disciplined Investor. The real word is speculating. Speculators Business Daily, or The Disciplined Speculator. I threw a curveball at you last week, didn't I, with show 79, an hour-long show, first of all, and an interview show with Russ Roberts. If you haven't listened to show 79, I do suggest you go and take a listen. Be forewarned that it is an hour long, and it's entirely composed of an interview with Russ Roberts about his Econ Talk podcast. Well, you listeners to the Mad Money Machine responded, I can tell, because before I interviewed Russ Roberts, his podcast was ranked number 11 in the iTunes Higher Education podcast rankings. And today I look, and his podcast is ranked number 6. So you guys have, in fact, gone out and subscribed to Econ Talk. Congratulations, I think you found something very good. On show 79 last week, we talked with Russ briefly about the use of index funds. I've been getting some emails from a website now for some time, a website that you should check out called indexuniverse.com. And it gives you a background of a lot of different topics in index investing if you really want to get down below the surface of it. I got my Xbox back from Texas, and it works just fine now, thank you very much. Before it wouldn't read DVDs very well, and now it reads them just fine. I'm going to try to keep it turned off instead of leaving it on. I actually invoked the auto shut-off feature so that if after 6 hours, it's still on. It automatically shuts itself off, at least, thinking that maybe heat is what causes the thing to go bad. Just got my copy of Halo 3 today and looking forward to getting involved in the culture that is Halo 3. Should be a pretty good game on the Xbox. Also downloaded the demo for BioShock, which looks really great. I love the Art Deco motif that they've got, and I may have to get that game as well. We'll be right back. Oh, I just had to play that one through the whole way at least one time. I've been using that as a bumper music for so long.
Also known as music to fill in the blanks.
That I don't think I've ever played the whole song once. So that's Ruby in the Dust by the Michael E. Thomas Band from the Podsafe Music Network. I listened to a show called Sound Investing, Merriman, Berkman, Next, whatever, from Seattle. It's a radio show that they redo as a podcast. And they talked with Paul B. Farrell the other day. He's a columnist for MarketWatch.com. And he mentioned the investment strategies of the 8-year-old. There was an 8-year-old kid who decided to invest in the market and that he had a great strategy for investing. And I see that also at IndexUniverse.com, an article that's called Lessons from an 8-year-old by Alan Roth. And he says that years ago, I told people that my son, Kevin, would be able to design a portfolio that could beat the vast majority of portfolios before he turned 8 years old. Well, he met that goal. But before he could design this portfolio, he had to learn two important lessons. One, don't play a loser's game. Two, don't put all your eggs in one basket. And he says it led him to take on Wall Street with only three funds. The Vanguard Total Stock Market Index, the Vanguard Total International Stock Index, and the Vanguard Total Bond Market Index. The Vanguard Total Stock Market Index, he calls the mother of all index funds. It owns the entire U.S. stock market. It totally accepts American capitalism and takes all the return the market has to give. In this one fund, Kevin has bought all sectors and styles of U.S. stocks that, according to MarketWatch columnist Paul B. Farrell, automatically rebalances for you. Morningstar analyst Sonia Morris points out that this rebalancing occurs without having to sell anything and recognize capital gains taxes. Now, the Vanguard Total International Stock Index is the international equivalent to the U.S. Total Stock Fund. And in order to reduce some short-term risk, you might want to put some money into the Vanguard Total Bond Market Index. He's got a table in this article called Wall Street Fantasy versus Reality. In the Wall Street wisdom, one size fits all never works, but the reality is different allocations of these three funds fit nearly everyone's risk levels. Wall Street wisdom says, you're guaranteeing that you will not beat the market, but the reality is you're guaranteeing that you'll beat most investors for this given risk level. Wall Street wisdom says, you can't diversify with only three funds. The reality is you're investing in thousands of stocks. Wall Street wisdom says investing isn't this simple. The reality is investing should be radically simple. Wall Street wisdom says this is a boring strategy. The reality is this is a really boring strategy, and it just works. So what are the lessons in this strategy? With only three funds, we can build a portfolio that, one, owns the entire world and has maximum global diversification, two, has less than 0.25% annual expenses, both hidden and disclosed, three, is extremely tax efficient, and four, automatically rebalances within U.S. and international markets. And so depending on one's risk level, you could, if you have a high-risk capacity, you could invest 60% in the Vanguard Total Stock Market, 30% in the Total International, and 10% in the bond. On the other extreme, if you have very low-risk tolerance, you could do 20% in the Total Stock Market, 10% in the International, and 70% in the Total Bond Market. So I think it's definitely worth checking out the 8-year-old's investing portfolio. Shall I tell you about an investing mistake that I made? It's one of these boneheaded things where I don't listen to my own advice. Market timing. I've told you about the tax loss harvesting. Well, I did take some additional tax losses about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And I took the money out. And there was a span of time there where I couldn't buy back into the one I wanted because it hadn't been 30 days yet. And so I waited. And wouldn't you know that I was waiting for the chance for stock market to come down below the point where I had sold it. And this is the horrific part of the story. The market continually went up from that point, and I never got back in. And then in the intervening time, the Federal Reserve cut the interest rate a half point, and the stocks zoomed up by, 2-3% on a single day. So I was out of the market during the big gains. I still haven't gotten back in. So I'm losing the opportunity cost of being in the market. So I really can't help myself. I'd like to play for you now a call I just got on the Mad Money Machine voicemail line, 206-734-4763.
Hi, Paul Douglas Blair. Hey, I'm calling to relate a story that I had about going to indexing, and you might want to use that in one of your podcasts. I'm currently in the military, and I'm going to relate this experience right here, hopefully not just for those in the military, but those who are getting into index funds and getting on them. Some time ago, about a half year ago, I was looking at some of my investments with a particular company that caters to those in the military. I can't say what their name is, but they think they're the first out there in terms of serving those. But anyways, so I had a lot of investments with them for about 5-6 years. And amazingly enough, one person that was working with me, he was actually the first sergeant in my company. He had seen that I was investing with him. And, you know, he knew so much about investing and was able to get me to look at what I had invested. In particular, we were looking at the funds that my advisor was trying to get me into besides the ones that I already had. And he wanted me to take a lot of money that I had, the cash, and put it into a particular company, which, again, I can't name that particular company, but I know they're headquartered in Massachusetts, and they claim to have a lot of fidelity toward their customers. But at any rate, looked at these particular investments. It took a long time to get the stock abbreviators or the fund abbreviators from the advisor. I couldn't figure it out for a while, and then figured out that basically he didn't want me to see the performance of them. It took an entire week to get the abbreviators. But anyways, it turned out they were pushing funds at 5.75% load. And at the time I thought I knew a lot about it, but no, and I think somebody else knew a lot more than I did. And we looked at this stuff, and it turned out to be quite unacceptable. But my fund advisor, or my investment advisor, still wanted me to get into these things right here. As a matter of fact, he even scoffed at my government thrift savings plan investments, which at the time were 0.05% for expense ratios with no loads, and now are even down to 0.03%, an extremely great value. In addition, the same funds, it turned out to be that the same funds from the same from that particular company, they had the same funds that were available, but they didn't have the word advisor attached to them, and they didn't have the same front-end loads. Amazing, you know, same funds, except didn't have the advisor, and with a higher load, because they had the word advisor onto it. That makes you really think. And they had the same performance and the same holdings, same exact fund manager. Well, anyways, I got appalled about what's happening right here, and so I decided to move all my retirement IRA funds and all my non-retirement funds to the tax-efficient index funds that you talk about so much in your show. And you know, to add to the whole definition or definitive way that we had done this right here, I had a book, Little Book of Common Sense Investing, by Jack Bogle, on my kitchen table. And you know, they do a good job of actually visiting their clients where they can, because they know a lot of us are busy. And it was actually in my house, and he came over and brought the paperwork for me to sign to release the funds from that particular company in Massachusetts. And it turned out that you know, he looked at the book, the title, and he said, well, you know, I wish it was that easy, you know. And at that point, it occurred to me that, you know, as nice as they were, this particular advisor was, he was either ignorant of what the truth was, or really just wanted to deceive me. And I really think it was the former. I hate to think of it as being the latter. But thanks for your time. You do a great podcast, and I recommend it to lots of people that I know at work. and the friends I have. Thanks.
Well, let me just say, wow. First of all, I appreciate your call and relating that story. If anybody else has a story like that to call in and leave on the voicemail line, it's 206-734-4763. But I appreciate that for several reasons. First of all, I kind of go through mood swings on this show thinking, what in the world am I doing this show for? I don't have anything to sell. What's my motivation for doing this thing? I don't have a book to sell. I don't have a financial advisor service to promote. And I'm not even a financial advisor by training. I'm not a CFP or a CPA or a CIP or whatever initials you want to put together. So why would anyone listen to me? And to hear a story that I've helped someone really helps me get motivated about spreading this information out there to you. So first of all, thank you for that. Second of all, I have to say, just how sad is it that people are taken advantage of in this way? And you can imagine why people are taken advantage of this way, because it's so very lucrative to take advantage of people who don't know any better about their money. Look how many bank buildings there are. Look how many commercials you see on TV. Have you ever watched a golf tournament on TV? Every other commercial break, there's something about some financial advisor, financial company. Well, if it takes money to make money, it sure takes a lot of your money to make them a whole lot of money, doesn't it? Insurance companies and this kind of broker and all this sort of stuff, they're making tremendous amount of money. In fact, financial services as a sector is making up a much larger percentage of the S&P 500 companies, whereas it used to be made up of energy companies and things like that. Now its financial services are growing more and more. The message has to be, it's our money, let's keep it for ourselves. And so I appreciate that story. The other part I want to say is congratulations for finding out of about a better way. I can imagine. Now, the part of this that you haven't told is that you did tell about the upfront sales load, which goes to the financial advisor. But the part you didn't tell about was, what is the recurring annual fee on these mutual funds that comes out of your investments and goes into their pocket annually? And can you imagine over a period of 30 years how much that 1% extra per year compounds to? It can really literally eat up one half of your final value over a long period of time like that. So instead of having $1 million in 30 years, you'd have half of that, $500,000 in 30 years' time. Congratulations on getting enlightened. So sad that you had to go through that. Thank you very much for the compliment. I'm so very happy that I've been able to help somebody. Thank you. Thank you so much. I want to play one of the classics from the Mad Money Machine archives. It's the musical version of Step 9.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. A 12-step program for active investors. Step 9, history. My name is Paul, and I'm an active investor. I suppose every investor has to go through this process. One late night, I was reading a book about investing. The quiet was deep. Then I realized, as I closed my eyes, that I could find hope in my history. And now I've traveled too far to change my mind. I've unraveled the mystery. At first, I didn't know quite what it was until I did my time.
Travels and fortune. Only a good understanding of the long-term historical risk and return of various indexes will enable investors to know how to allocate their investments in accordance with their personal risk capacity. Over the 78-year period the data is available, small value has outperformed the S&P 500 and large-cap growth funds. It's interesting to note that over the 48-year period, emerging market public equities outperformed venture capital and at a lower risk level. Gold and silver are also interesting, reinforcing the idea that they have lots of risk and returns pretty close to T-bills and bonds. In addition to the long-term risk and returns of indexes, the third input used to create optimal portfolios is cross-correlation. Cross-correlation refers to the extent to which performances of different asset classes move in relation to each other. The lower the correlation among different indexes in a portfolio, the greater the diversification, which means lower volatility of returns. If you're confused about the expected returns on your investments, if you don't know your history, we're here to rescue you. We're here to bring you home.
Is there somewhere you can rescue me? Somewhere you can bring me home again? Somewhere you can rescue me? Rescue me.
I'd like to encourage you to go check out all the musical interpretations of all 12 steps at madmoneymachine.com and click the 12 steps tab. So I've talked in a previous show about a book I read called Soccer Head, about a guy who became a soccer coach unintentionally and learned to love and become obsessed by soccer. Read that book. That was pretty good. And now that book pointed me to another book called Offside, Soccer and American Exceptionalism. And what they mean by exceptionalism is not how great America is, but how different America is from the rest of the world in soccer. Back cover of the book says, soccer is the world's favorite pastime, a passion for billions around the globe. In the United States, however, the sport is a distant also-ran behind football, basketball, baseball, and hockey. Why is America an exception, and why, despite America's leading role in popular culture, does most of the world ignore American sports in return? The book provides a comparative analysis of sports cultures in the industrial societies of North America and Europe. And the book notes that America, first of all, is one of the only countries in the world to have 3.5 major sports that people focus on. No other country in the world has that many sports that they rally around to such an extent. Most countries have the one sport, soccer. Some countries have two. And you know what the other sport is? Certainly not American football. American football is unique to America. It is, of course, basketball. A lot of other countries have basketball as their second largest sport to soccer. Why is it that America has these different sports? The book claims that the formative years of sports popular sport were between 1880 and 1930, and back then, when America was developing sport, they borrowed from England a game called Rounders, which was a kid's game where you use a bat to hit a ball. They created this sport called baseball, and some of the colleges took up a game much like rugby, which started in England, of course, changed the rules greatly over time to make it into football. And then thirdly, about that time, some guy in a YMCA somewhere hung up a basket and invented basketball. This is a unique sport in that they can identify the particular date that a man invented this game, basketball. So the book talks about the struggle that soccer has competing with the other big 3.5 sports. And one of the problems is college soccer actually impedes the rise of professional soccer. Here are the reasons. Number one, the college season, they say. It's the biggest handicap. The NCAA has rules prohibiting the playing of any competitive contest in a sport out of its designated season. And so it says, the book says, that this really hinders the development of young athletes to rise to a higher level in the sport. Of course, I wonder, doesn't that apply to basketball and football as well? But I don't understand the difference there. The second reason the college hinders professional soccer is the rules. They say that college doesn't conform to FIFA rules.
And in particular, the ones that are most egregious are that they allow unlimited substitutions. And I'll quote the book. It says, "With few players allowed to play complete games, and by relying on athletic ability over general feel for the game, college soccer has consistently emphasized technique, athleticism, and patterned or learned play over improvisation and a certain playfulness that cannot be taught in a systematic manner, but can only be acquired on the field itself." They say it fosters a culture of specializations that has become an integral part of the set-patterned system of American football, but has always been somewhat alien to the much more fluid and improvised nature of soccer. Third reason colleges hinder is the college coaches. There are very few coaches that have hailed from the world of professional soccer. They name some that have, but they say most of them have not. And the fourth reason is the very existence of colleges per se as major loci of sports in America. They say while football and basketball have thrived through college athletics, soccer's marginality in this sphere will, in our view, continue to impede its progress toward attaining a status approaching that of the big 3.5 in the United States. It's universally accepted that the years of age between 18 and 22 are totally critical in the development of skills necessary for playing soccer at its highest level. Spending those years in NCAA soccer simply does not suffice for establishing those skills. Now, they do go on to talk about the difference there with women's soccer, and also something called Project 40, which began in 1996-97 at the behest of the MLS, precisely to counter the inevitable bifurcation between a college education and the uncertainty of a professional soccer career that all 18-year-old soccer talents have had to confront. For the very first time, an organizational mechanism has been put into place in the United States that is explicitly designed to eliminate this stultifying dead end. So I am in the middle of this book, and I'm looking forward to getting to its conclusion. Right where I am now in the book, it's talking about the massive rise in youth soccer and how that might impact the sport in years to come. They also talk about how many, many millions of children play soccer in the virtually the same way that they see it played on TV in a professional level, and how few people play football in the way that it's played on TV. And now I have just looked up in Wikipedia, no less, what this Project 40 thing is. And it says until 2005, there was a program sponsored by Nike that was called Project 40. But now that's called Generation Adidas, which is a joint venture between Major League Soccer and the United States Soccer Federation, aimed to raise the level of young soccer talent in the United States. In the program, sponsored by Adidas, it encourages early entry, without college graduation, of American players into the Major League Soccer. And so what they actually do is they take promising college kids and they pay them to join some MLS teams, at least train with them. And if they don't work out on the MLS, they pay for their college education. Sounds like a pretty good deal. Since September is the ninth month and step nine is history, I want to get all academic on you here and talk about the third component of making up your portfolio. So in addition to risk and return, you also need to look at cross-correlation among indexes that you might choose. Well, of course, cross-correlation refers to the extent which performances of different asset classes move in relationship with each other. And the idea is that the lower the correlation among the different indexes in a portfolio, the greater the diversification, which means lower volatility of your returns. If indexes are highly correlated, then their prices are responding to market news in the same direction at the same time. Market news that affects prices in all markets include the overall strength of the U.S. economy, consumer confidence, the level of interest rates, and expectations for inflation rates, so forth. A low correlation, on the other hand, means that market prices of different indexes react in different directions to the same news. These indexes have market price movements that aren't connected, showing a low similarity in movement to each other. For example, large company stocks and small company stocks historically have had a lower correlation. And of course, large company stocks and one-year fixed income securities have had very low correlation, 0.01, which means there's almost no correlation between the market price movement of these two asset classes. The next best diversifier of risk is low positive correlation among asset classes in a portfolio. By designing the proper mix of low correlation index funds, it's possible to lower a portfolio's risk, and here's the key, and increase its risk-adjusted return at the same time. At times, investors may doubt whether the fundamentals of capitalism and the relationship between risk and return will hold up into the future. For example, the August 13, 1979 issue of Business Week magazine declared on its cover, "Are equities dead?" This was after 10 years of lousy performance. It must really have appeared that way. For the 11-year period between 1969 and 1979, the S&P average annual compound return was only 4.5%. And it was even worse, 3.2% for the 7-year period, 73 to 79, just before that article. Those kind of returns made it seem as if stocks were no longer a viable investment. Therefore, many investors decided to invest only in treasury bills, which outperformed stocks for both periods, and they wanted to avoid the risk of stocks. Of course, the concern that the fundamental relationship between risk and return wouldn't hold up was as ridiculous then as it is now. An analysis of multiple year rolling periods offers an interesting way to sort out these kinds of concerns. There's a figure in the book Index Funds, a 12-step program for active investors, that shows that for the 10-year rolling periods, shifting 1 month at a time over the 79 years from 1926 to 2004, the S&P 500 index outperformed T-bills 85.1% of the time. In the 696 20-year periods, the S&P 500 index outperformed T-bills 100% of the time. But in one-year periods, it only outperformed 67.8% of the time. This brings to mind Benjamin Graham's observation that in the short run, the market is a voting machine, but in the long run, it is a weighing machine. The bottom line is that a good understanding of the long-term historical risk and return and cross-correlation of various indexes enables an investor to know how to construct an efficient asset allocation according to their risk capacity. Risk and return will work themselves out over the long term or revert to the mean. In the meantime, the best bet is to diversify among index funds that are structured for optimal exposure to risk factors that history has shown to be the most rewarding. This is Paul Douglas Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes fill in the blank to make a mad money machine. I'll see you next week. Remember to visit our sponsor, Index Funds Advisors, at ifa.com. Take their risk capacity survey. It is the best way to get started down your path of investing. Some music on this program provided by music.podshow.com. Give me a call at the voicemail line, 206-734-4763, or email me feedback@madmoneymachine.com. And check out the website, madmoneymachine.com.